So it's my great pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea our speaker for the evening, Francis Geddes, author of the book Contemplative Healing. He is a United Church of Christ parish minister, and as well as author of the book, which presumably we have some copies of over here on the table here. And he has been, well, I should preface this by saying a number of years ago, the importance of Jesus' healing role, as highlighted in the Gospels, was brought to my attention by a variety of writers. And Francis is the first one that I know of who has brought that awareness into modern practice. A very interesting role that he has undertaken to share the idea of the congregation as healing community with, and healing itself as an aspect of spiritual practice with, contemporary Christian congregations. So it is my great pleasure to welcome Francis Geddes to Many Rivers Books and Tea to speak on this topic.
Thank you so much. Well, I've prayed harder in my life to find the right place, but I don't think I've prayed any harder than I did tonight. Where is it? Finally, I phoned and got myself together enough to, and I was very close. So it's good to be here. The healing process that I've taught for more than 35, 40 years is what I call contemplative healing. It's difficult to describe the process in words because it is the spiritual experience that cannot be captured in words, but can only be captured in spiritual practice. Our ordinary consciousness is like an untrained mind. Our ordinary consciousness is like a wild, unbroken horse that loves to run wild in the prairie of the open prairie of the mind, joyfully running here and there, but with very little focus. The contemplative exercises that I use for healing training discipline the wonderful energy of the unfocused mind that loves to gallop around on the prairie of inner consciousness. I learned this process from my mentor, Dr. Lawrence LeShon, a research psychologist, but with enormous, enormous spiritual depth. In this training, students learn how these contemplative exercises can put the vast energy of the mind to work for the transformation of consciousness. In this change, the prayerful, focused mind becomes a powerful lens that can direct God's healing light. Imagine, if you would, a field of dry grass with a hot sun shining over it, and it's shining on every blade of grass. And imagine someone holding a magnifying glass over a small clump of that dry grass, focusing the sun's heat until it catches fire and transforms the grass into flame. I use that as a metaphor. Imagine the sun represents God's healing light that shines down on all of us in every moment. And our prayers for healing focus the light and the energy of God. It's like holding a magnifying glass that focuses God's healing light toward someone who is ill is, I think, how healing happens. When God's light is focused, transformation happens. Healing and wholeness often result. However, the mind must be very focused and tuned in order to transmit God's energy. And light in a concentrated way. So I train my students to practice contemplative exercises that can tune the mind and heart so they can be instruments of God's in God's hands. Contemplative exercises are important as a spiritual discipline that prepares the mind for the healing prayer. And the story of my own healing journey is recounted in the book Contemplative Healing, The Congregation is Healing Community. The book describes how the practice of healing took hold of my consciousness in the early 1970s. I was a 52-year-old pastor at the First Congregational Church in San Rafael. Now, my seminary education at the Yale Divinity School seemed to hold Jesus' ministry of healing at arm's length. Yes, we studied the healing stories in the New Testament that describe Jesus' healing, but they were also viewed as theological myths created by the early church as teaching stories, and therefore in today's world seemed to have no practical use for us. In my seminary community, there was very little interest, if any, in healing. For me, all that changed 20 years later when I met Dr. LaShawn, psychologist in the humanistic tradition, who grew up in a Jewish family, but he was not, and nor was the family, a practicing Jew. I attended a 5-day residential seminar on healing that he led in the Santa Cruz Mountains in 1974. And he taught us about a dozen contemplative exercises drawn from the world's great religions. I had a dream about 2 weeks before attending the seminar. In the dream, I was inside a cabin with a group of about 10 people, but I was standing on my head. And when I arrived at the seminar site and we gathered for our first session in a cabin, and it was the cabin I'd seen in my dream. Meeting LaShawn and learning his healing process tipped me upside down in a wonderful way. So I didn't know what the dream meant until after 6 or 8 weeks later, when I discovered that I had been tipped upside down. I've not been the same since that time. And later, LaShawn asked me to teach in his healing research project, and I worked with him at a distance. He was in New York City, and I was in Marin County, California. I worked with him for about 18 months, and then I had taught his healing seminars. And then I branched out and began teaching his process on my own. I modified his foundation in humanistic psychology, and I set it into a progressive Christian context. Using LaShawn's method, I've taught about 1,000 people here on the West Coast to do what I call contemplative healing in 5-day residential retreats or during 3 consecutive Saturday workshops, 12 people at a time. I've been teaching this nearly 40 years. And I began writing my book on healing in 1999. I've had many powerful experiences with healing prayer that have pushed me to write about it so that a wider audience might become aware of this remarkable resource that Jesus introduced so long ago, but which the mainline church today puts on the margin of its practice. It doesn't take it very seriously. In my own theology, I view Jesus as one of the prophets, Jesus never was, as you probably know, Jesus never was a Christian. He was born a Jew, he lived as a Jew, he died as a Jew. And to me, Christianity is a Jewish sect that outgrew its origin. And so I'm as much Jewish as I am Christian, because Jesus and all the disciples never saw themselves as Christian or something other than Jewish. So am I Jewish or Christian? I'm both. And I believe that every Christian is the same, but they won't know it and they don't acknowledge it. In the fall of 1889, when I was pastor of the Fairfax Community Church in Marin County, a retired nurse in the congregation was diagnosed with cancer in the abdominal cavity. Her surgeon told her that she had 2 months to live. Now, she knew from her condition, she knew that her condition was serious. But she also knew from many years of nursing experience that sometimes doctors are wrong. And she refused to lie down and die on schedule. She was a fighter. She was very gutsy. She was hilariously funny, sometimes irreverent, and very courageous. 18 months later, she decided to accompany her husband on a UC Extension archaeology dig in Greece, 3 weeks in Greece. And when she returned, several members of the congregation and I formed a healing prayer group that met weekly to pray with her. She followed her oncologist's advice with a regime of chemotherapy. A year went by, 2 years, 3 years. She held her own. But in the fourth year, the cancer symptoms returned. And during those last months of her life, I learned so much about how one can face life's tragedies without complaint. Her chutzpah never left her, and her humor was always there. Joy Mays modeled an enormous strength of purpose for everyone around her. Without saying a word, she taught me and many in her family and in the congregation. She taught all of us how to die in style. And I'm forever in her debt. Her body was deteriorating, but her personhood was whole. She was not cured, but she most certainly died healed. And here I'm defining healing in a way that is rooted in the word wholeness. If a person is whole, they're healed. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're cured. In fact, as with her, she went on to die 3 months later. But she died whole. And that's the distinction I'd like to make. She died healed. Now, the word heal comes from 3,000-year-old Indo-European root word, kylo, which means to make whole. And Joy Mays died whole. I also want to tell you a story about a hospital chaplain intern who attended one of my healing trainings at a Roman Catholic retreat center in July 1998. She had been living in significant pain for a number of years with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Her whole life revolved around one issue: how to minimize the pain, how to keep it at bay, so that it did not dominate her whole life. She took 70 milligrams of prednisone every day for years. And those of you who have any medical background know that 70 milligrams of prednisone every day is a very heavy dose. Everyone in the training receives a 10-minute healing from the group. And when her turn came, she received about 7 minutes of silent imagery, healing prayer. The 10 of us then concluded our prayer with laying on of hands for about 3 minutes. And during those 10 minutes, she received, by God's grace, a very significant release from pain. It simply vanished. She was astonished, and group members were dumbfounded. There was a slight residue of pain, but 3 weeks later, it was gone completely. It has not returned since July of 1998. And she's had checkups every year. In my 40 years of teaching healing prayer, this kind of healing is very, very rare. All of us who participated in the healing were shaken by God's grace in action. I know I was shaken by it. People often receive benefit from a healing, but sometimes they don't experience anything. And I tell this story because I want there to be openness in the modern mind that says, yes, this kind of healing is possible. In my passion for healing, I want to help recover this neglected practice for today, which in my tradition, Jesus began 2,000 years ago. And so my teaching and my book seek to provide the Spirit with an opportunity to work its mysterious power in the life of a congregation as well as individual lives. In the life of most mainline congregations today, as I mentioned earlier, and by mainline I mean Methodist, Episcopal, Lutheran, United Church of Christ, Baptist, Disciples, Roman Catholic, etc. In the life of these congregations, healing is usually an activity practiced on the side, and it doesn't get a lot of attention by and large, with exception in a congregation here and there where it gets a lot of attention. For Jesus, however, healing was an integral part of what he called the kingdom of God. And the New Testament scholar John Dominic Crossan suggests that Jesus' first disciples were those who had received healing themselves from Jesus. The apostles, or literally the sent out ones, were given a mission by Jesus. Crossan says the missionaries were not some specific and closed group sent out on one particular mission at one particular time. They were predominantly healed healers, part of whose continuous healing was precisely their empowerment to heal others. Crossan continues, I proposed, in other words, a network of shared healing with Jesus. End of quote from one of the great New Testament scholars of our time. In this shared healing with Jesus, healed healers continue to offer this practice that Jesus began so long ago. And when we pray in Jesus' name, we invite the presence of the risen Christ into that prayer and into our lives. My teaching and my book seek to provide the Spirit with an opportunity to work its mysterious power in the life of a congregation or meditation group. When people pray and ask the Spirit to intercede with those who are ill, the Spirit has an opportunity to touch and shape that group or congregation in a direct way. I've seen that happen in several groups and in several congregations. In the book, I suggest that Jesus brought a new teaching into the Judaism of his day. He described the kingdom of God not only in parables and metaphors, but it was also communicated in the practice of sacred healing that he must have taught his disciples. These were fishermen, many of them, peasants. They were not educated at all. And he sent them out to communicate the good news, and part of that was to heal. That was part of the good news. So it's been my experience that the practice of healing changes the leaders and the lay people who have had the training and who offer healing regularly. They often discover that this practice transforms their lives in significant ways. In an interview with the Reverend Jim Moiso, who was minister of Westminster Presbyterian Church in Portland, Oregon, I asked him, "What meaning does this healing practice have for you personally?" He replied, "It's really changed my ministry. I have an awareness of a part of myself that was there, but was not so nearly in tune with it. This is not wholly new, but rather a kind of blowing open something that may have been latent for a long time. This began with my wife's encounter with cancer and my praying around that illness. This has added a powerful dimension to my ministry. I see what I do now through brokenness and healing more clearly than I ever have. It is a lens that is here all of the time. It may have existed before, but I wasn't so aware of it. Also, that lens is present when I think about who God is and what God intends. I am much more conscious of that than I have ever been. And somehow, in our halting way, we get to be a vehicle of God. And it does make a difference to other people." End of his quote to me. However, there are skeptics who disagree with my thesis and would say that Jim Moiso is kidding himself. Professor Richard Sloan of Columbia Medical School in New York City writes, "There are no plausible mechanisms that account for how somebody's thought or prayers can influence the health of another person. None. We know of nothing. Can one person's thoughts affect another person's body?" Professor Sloan responds, "The answer is pretty unequivocally no." End of quote. Now, there are other scientists who disagree. Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, an anthropologist and former president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, she's a world authority on the scientific studies of distant healing. Dr. Schlitz and other scientists at the Institute have conducted what has come to be called the Love Study. It's an experiment that shows how the focused, loving thought of one partner in a loving couple is registered as a change of blood flow and perspiration in the other partner, though they are in separate rooms, many feet apart. In one experiment, Dr. Schlitz worked with a loving couple, Tina and J.D. Miller. Implications of this experiment are that when love is focused consciously to another person at a distance, that focused love can be measured in a change of blood pressure, perspiration, of the person receiving love at a distance. Prayer for another person's health at a distance is a form of focused love, which now can show up on scientific instruments. I never dreamed that you could see love on an oscilloscope, but that's what Dr. Schlitz and her fellow researchers showed. Here's a quote from the script of a broadcast on National Public Radio describing part of this experiment. It was presented by Barbara Haggerty on her program The Science of Spirituality on June 5th, 2009. And I quote from the script of this television show. Schlitz takes Tina into an isolated room where no sound can come in or go out. Tina settles into a deep armchair as Schlitz attaches electrodes to her right hand. She says, "This is measuring blood flow in your thumb, and this is our skin conductance activity," the researcher explains. "So basically, both of these are measures of your unconscious nervous system." Schlitz took Tina into the electromagnetically shielded chamber, then ushers J.D. into an isolated room with a closed-circuit television. She explains that the screen will go on and off, and at random intervals, Tina's image will appear on the screen for 10 seconds. "And so during the time when you see her," she instructs, "it's your opportunity to think about sending loving, compassionate intention." As the sessions begin, Dean Radin, a senior scientist here, watches as a computer shows changes in JD's blood pressure and perspiration. When JD sees the image of his wife, the steady lines suddenly jump and become ragged. The question is, will Tina's nervous system follow suit? An hour later, Radin displays Tina's graph, which shows a flat line during the times her husband was not staring at her image. But when he began to stare at her, she stopped relaxing and became aroused within about 2 seconds. And after running 36 couples through this test, the researchers found that when one person focused his thoughts on his partner at a distance, the partner's blood flow and perspiration dramatically changed within 2 seconds. The odds of this happening by chance were 1 in 11,000. 36 double-blind randomized studies by such institutions as the University of Washington and the University of Edinburgh have reported similar results. This description of the Love Project, and that's the end of the quote of the script. Now, this description of the Love Project I've just shared with you is not in my book, as it went to press before the information was available. So how do you explain this? That person in an isolated copper-clad room, 50 feet away from another person, can pick up when love is communicated. Not consciously, but their perspiration, their EKG, there's a readout that this is communicated. Love can be communicated. Now, how do you explain this? Well, no one really knows. But Dean Radin and a few others think that a theory known as quantum entanglement may offer some clues. Here's how it works. Once two particles have interacted, if you separate them even by miles, they behave as if they're still connected. So far, this has only been demonstrated on the subatomic level. But Radin wonders, could people in close relationships, couples, siblings, parent and child, also be entangled, not just emotionally and psychologically, but also physically, through some mysterious, unknown way of communicating energy? If it's true that entanglement actually persists by means of which we don't understand, Dean Radin says, if they are physically entangled, you should be able to separate them, poke one, and see the other one flinch. Now, the idea that we may be connected at some molecular level echoes the words of mystics down through the ages. And it appeals to some scientists, but infuriates other scientists, as you might imagine. Skeptics like Dr. Sloan are not persuaded. However, those of us who have seen some positive results of healing prayer over the years now have an interesting readout of what might be happening objectively when we focus our love and prayer for healing. A loving connection can become visible on the screen of an oscilloscope. to me, that's rather radical, because all of us grew up in a belief system dominated by the scientific worldview. That's the belief system that's unexamined, and it's part of our culture. And what happened in the Love Project and the experiment defies current scientific worldview, quote, scientific laws. Dr. Sloan is not persuaded. Even with the evidence, he's not persuaded. Now, this is not scientific proof that healing prayer grounded in love can be measured. I'm not claiming that. But I think it does illustrate that we can be connected to other human beings through the energy of focused love. Healing prayer, by its very nature, is focused love. In a New Testament letter, the Apostle John suggests that God is love. And the healing that Jesus did, certainly all the healing stories communicate love. So that's some of my thoughts this evening on healing and contemplative prayer. Questions, comments, reactions, objections? Yes.
I enjoyed your talk very much. I enjoyed your book. I enjoyed your talk and the book. I read the book. And I like the distinction you make between healing and cure, being cured.
Yes.
And I was wondering, do you teach any cautions in being involved in healing to prevent one from either taking on the illness of another person, you know, to oneself,
yes,
or taking away an important experience, a learning experience that this illness is, you know, intending for the person, which I'll have to learn some other way in the future.
Yes.
So these two questions.
Okay. Well, let me answer the second one question. I don't believe that God intends anyone to continue in pain just to learn a lesson. And I don't, every time Jesus was confronted with the pain of someone who wanted healing, he immediately gave it. And he never said to them, well, I can't do any healing with you today because you need the lesson that you're going to learn from this pain you're in. I don't see Jesus doing that. And the first part of your observation, refresh my memory.
Yeah, the first one was what protection can a healer have to prevent
yeah.
them from taking on the illness?
Okay.
Some healers
yeah.
seem to take on the illness of the people they're healing.
That's possible. And in the preliminary meditation exercises that I teach, and my daughter Anne teaches, we have an exercise that we call grounding. And I have people do a visual exercise of becoming a tree. From the waist down, they are the root system beginning at the ground going down. From the waist up, they are trunk and branches. And they visualize the trunk and the roots in the ground, they visualize the green branches. Now, that is a grounding exercise that keeps one from being pulled off center by someone's illness. And the way I teach healing, the way LaShawn taught healing, is that you do it through images rather than words. You see two sparrows on a wire, and in your mind's eye you know that eventually the two sparrows will come together and merge and become one, and that one of the sparrows represents you, the other sparrow represents the person who is ill. And so you're using these mental images, and those are not connected to you. Those are images in your mind, and they're very healing, because I've used that exercise hundreds and hundreds of times, and sometimes now and then the readout is very positive. So what I'm saying is, you don't pick up somebody else's negative energy if you don't identify with their pain. And one of the ways of not identifying with their pain is to do these two images coming together. And in my imagery, I'll see two deer coming slowly together, and the moment they come together and are one, I see Jesus putting his arms around the shoulders of the deer. Maybe it's a buck and a doe, but I see Jesus doing that, and I have not had an experience of picking up somebody else's pain. I've had students who've picked up other people's pain because they didn't ground or they didn't do the contemplative exercises necessary to prepare the mind, because the mind is such, in India it's called the monkey mind. It's jumping around. It's trying to run the show. And so that kind of monkey mind has to be quieted and focused. And that's what the contemplative exercises do. They quiet and focus the mind so that you're turning over to God a tuned instrument. And that tuned instrument does not pick up another person's pain.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is this always done in groups?
It's more powerful when it's done in groups. And part of my lament is that 80, maybe 90% of the literature of healing prayer is about one powerful individual healer who does wonderful things. And I'm in favor of a powerful individual healer doing wonderful things, but it gives a false impression, is that it's only a powerful healer that can do that. And my experience is that a group meditating together, very serious concentration exercises drawn from Buddhism, Sufism, Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism. These exercises keep one from being distracted, or keep one from going off center. Does that answer your question?
Well, I was thinking of the individual. Some of us meditate, contemplate individually.
Yeah.
From what I know of what your book is, that you advocate the group doing
it. I have found that the group is more powerful than an individual.
I see.
By and large, because the most dramatic healings that I've witnessed in my 40 years experience has all happened in groups. And when you have 10 or 12 people who have been over a period, let's say a month, following contemplative practice and tuning the mind so that God can use a tuned instrument. When you bring those people together, I would just love to see what an EKG would look like for everybody in that group when they do the healing, and particularly when the two images merge and people become one, and Christ is invited into the mix. Does that answer your question? Good. Anybody else?
So you said 10 or 12 months of contemplative training? Is that what you...
Well, the training is either a 5-day residential seminar, or I've shortened it because people can't take 5 days often. So it's now 3 Saturdays back to back, consecutive Saturdays. And I have people practice between the Saturdays using these contemplative exercises. Now, that's enough training to be able to, when a group comes together, they practice these exercises together, the whole energy level seems to go up. And the healings seem, in my experience, to be more powerful. And there's very little research on group healing. And I'm sorry that that's the case, because I think it has a greater potential for lay people who are not meditators or spiritual athletes. It has a greater potential for them being part of a group and doing the exercises after they've had the training. Now, do they have to do it for months, years? I don't think you can answer that question, because God chooses when healing is going to happen. And we do our part and then let go. And that's my teaching, is that we offer to God our very best and then we let go, so that either the presence of Christ or the Spirit of God or both can move into the illness, the pain.
And you're not just talking about physical pain, are you?
No. I'm talking about emotional pain, talking about grief, talking about frustration,
anger.
And it takes quite a mature person to want to have prayer to help him or her handle the anger. It happens. I know people who have prayed for handling their anger, but it doesn't happen very often. It takes kind of what I'll call a psychological and a spiritual maturity to want to pray to God, please help me with my anger.
Don't mind my saying something. I read something contemplative today that said guilt can be a way of hanging on to our anger.
Oh, that's interesting. I like that. Yes, guilt can be a way of hanging on to our anger. Yeah.
I noticed that you said that it takes a mature person to want the prayer, and that made me want to ask you, in your experience, does it generally work better if the person receiving the prayer is wanting it or open to it?
Yes.
Or is it required almost?
It's not required, but it means the person is more open. Sometimes the person is not open for a variety of distractions. But one of my favorite stories told about Jesus' healing was a woman with a flow of blood who came to him in the crowd, unknown to him, touched his garment, and he felt the energy go out of his body. And he knew that a healing had occurred. And then he turns around in the crowd and says, "Who touched my cloak?" And the disciples look at him like he's crazy. "What do you mean, who touched you? Is the crowd pushing in here?" And he says, "Somebody touched." And then the woman comes forward and confesses that she was the one who touched his cloak. And his remark is commenting on her attitude toward healing. And he said, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole." And in the King James translation of Mark's Gospel, the word "whole" is used and not healed or well. In the New Standard Revised, I think it's well. Your faith has made you well. In the King James Version, closer to the root word of healing, kylo, your faith has made you whole. And he gives her the credit, saying, daughter, you did it. And he calls her daughter, making her a, what shall I call it, a mystical member of his family. He loves her and gives her a great deal of credit for the healing that happened, that she... So the healee's attitude is important. And because a negative attitude or skepticism can distract the healing energy or distract the person so that they're not really open. And you can't do healing with somebody who's not really open. Or at least I've never seen that happen.
Dennis, are you planning to give one of these seminars soon?
No, I've stopped giving them because I've discovered I can't remember from week to week when I do the Saturdays what happened last Saturday. And my memory, even, or what happened 2 hours ago in a day-long Saturday retreat. My daughter Anne does do training, and she has a chapter in the book describing the technique of what happens during the imagery healing prayer. So she does training, and let me give you her phone number in case you're curious and want to find. She works with a Lutheran church in Petaluma, and I've forgotten the name of it. But Anne's phone number is area code 415-493-5041. She lives in Novato and is willing to teach, to lecture, to do a day workshop on healing. And she's very good at what she does.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
Are you familiar with attitudinal healing, like from Gerald Schimpulse?
I have examined some of the literature, yes.
Yeah, where his kind of idea is about staying focused on the presence and on the present time and avoiding a lot of thoughts in the past or the future.
Yeah.
Focusing on forgiving.
Yes.
And accepting that the past is the past.
Right.
And just working on the present and being kind of being here now, and that's his method of healing.
I think that's a powerful process. I don't think it is a universal process. If you have certain issues in your heart and mind that need a particular kind of forgiveness, a challenge of forgiveness, that works beautifully. If it's not the challenge of forgiveness, if you have other issues, I'm not sure it is what I'll call a universal healing technique. But I don't put it down. I just say I think it's limited to certain kinds of problems.
Probably more like emotional or...
Yeah.
Interpersonal relationships and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming here, and I am dumbfounded that I could not find this place. because I swear I'd been here before, and I have, and I was convinced it was on the other side of the street, and how that conviction got into my head, I do not know, but I need healing.
Well, finding your way through the door was the healing tonight. Let's agree on that. And on behalf of many rivers and our audience, thank you so much for.
You're very welcome. Very welcome. I have books, Contemplative Healing.
Yes.
That I'd be glad. They're in those plastic bags. There are two packages of them. I think they're about 9 or 10. But we're not probably going to sell 9 or 10.
But you can take these out and you can take a look. It's a very good book. And please do check it out. We have also a generosity or Donna bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it. We share that with our speaker to further his work. And then retain some to maintain this space for further events in the future. We are delighted you could come tonight. We're delighted you found us tonight.
Yeah.
Well, I think someone was watching over me because I was flat out, and then all of a sudden, get somebody to phone. And how it took me 45 minutes to come to that, I don't know, but thank God I did, and thank you for your gracious welcome.
Sometimes asking for help is hard, but
yes.
It's part of the healing process.
Yes. Particularly those of us in the helping professions, asking for healing or help is hard.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much again.
You're very,
thank you
very
all
welcome
for coming tonight.